content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Jazz Just Lost One of Its All-Time Greats by David Graham. In a 2014 interview, the saxophonist Wayne Shorter was asked how often his working quartet rehearsed. His reply was evasive and illuminating. How do you rehearse the future? This was classic Shorter, gnomic, gnostic, mischievous, wise. It was a bit of a humble brag, too. For more than 6 days, he conjured the future of music into being, with or without the benefit of rehearsal. Shorter, who died March 2nd, at 89, was a giant of jazz as an improviser, bandleader, and thinker, but above all as a composer, arguably the greatest in jazz since Thelonious Monk, and inarguably one of the greatest the genre in the United States has ever produced. Consider two of Shorter's most famous songs. Footprints, a hypnotic blues in three-quarter time, is superficially simple enough that it's a staple for high school jazz combos and adventurous rock bands. Nefertiti, from the same era, is so immaculately constructed that when Miles Davis, Shorter's employer at the time, recorded it on an album of the same title, he simply had the band play the melody over and over for nearly 8 minutes, without any solos. The album begins with Shorter's saxophone delivering the melody, which starts on a descending riff that gives the impression that the listener is stepping into a conversation already in progress, which in a way you are. In these many of his enduring compositions, Shorter's music is a sort of abstract expressionism, along the lines of paintings by Helen Frankenthaler, his contemporary, who herself was influenced by jazz. Both artists' work is saturated in color, but restrained, unpredictable, and free, yet self-contained, and imbued with alluring enigma. Over his career, Shorter was a member of four of the most important jazz bands to ever play, traversing the path from post-bop to the contemporary cutting edge. In Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, jazz's premier finishing school, Shorter was musical director. Next, he jumped to Miles Davis's second great quintet, serving as lead composer as the group defined acoustic jazz in the 1960s, then went electric. In the 1970s and 80s, Shorter co-led Weather Report, a premium jazz fusion band, with Joe Zawinul. In the 21st century, Shorter convened an acoustic quartet that was a fitting heir to Davis's band for musicianship and innovation. Every first-rate jazz musician must be an excellent team player, but Shorter seemed to find a particular inspiration in close collaboration with other musicians. In Blakey's band, he was paired on the front line with the mercurial trumpeter Lee Morgan. Shorter was the cool to Morgan's hot. As a teenager in Newark, New Jersey, who was obsessed with science fiction and comics, Shorter dubbed himself Mr. Weird. The band was one of the best examples of the blues and gospel-inflected jazz of the era, known as hard bop. Shorter also released several excellent albums under his own name in the 1960s, but his best-known work in that decade was with Davis. After his famous band with John Coltrane split up, the trumpeter worked to ensemble a new band of comparable caliber, eventually landing on a lineup featuring Tony Williams on drums, Herbie Hancock on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Shorter on saxophone. Although every member contributed songs, Shorter wrote the most, and his influence extended beyond just those compositions. Wayne was the idea person, the conceptualizer of a whole lot of musical ideas we did, Davis wrote in his autobiography. Wayne has always been someone who experimented with form instead of someone who did it without form. Wayne is a real composer. He writes scores, writes the part for everybody, just as he wants them to sound. As Davis began experimenting with electric keyboards and guitar, Shorter stayed with Davis and played on the path-breaking electric records In a Silent Way and Bitches Brew. In spring 1970, however, he left the band, joining up with Zawinul, an Austrian keyboardist who had also contributed to those records, to form Weather Report. The group became the longest-lasting and most commercially successful of the great jazz fusion bands, staying together until 1986 and producing the infectious crossover hit Birdland. Though its output was sometimes uneven, Weather Report managed to avoid the excesses and cheesiness associated with fusion. Zawinul came to dominate Weather Report compositionally and sonically, but Shorter's horn playing and writing were essential to the group's success. His Sightseeing, an underappreciated classic, has recently enjoyed a new attention from younger musicians such as Christian McBride and Anthony Fung. Shorter also contributed a centerpiece solo to Steely Dan's Asia in 1977 and played on multiple Joni Mitchell records. His greatest post-Weather Report project didn't appear until 2000 when he formed a quartet with pianist Danilo Perez, the bassist John Patitucci, and the drummer Brian Blade. Like Davis's second great quintet, this band paired an eminence with players from a younger generation. Like the Davis band, this one expanded the bounds of acoustic jazz. The first time I heard them live in Edinburgh in 2003 was one of the most dazzling performances I've seen. Playing without written music, the four musicians seemed psychically linked, navigating often obscure structures, none of the standard form of a melody, then a series of solos, then another turn through the melody. The band could lurch in any direction or around hairpin turns without warning, but always functioned as one. A percussive explosion from Blade or surprise Montuno from Perez would lead the music somewhere unexpected. The group released three excellent live recordings. Shorter continued to produce music at a high level nearly to the end of his life. His 1918 Eminon, which paired the quartet with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra and came with a graphic novel co-written by Shorter, topped many jazz critics' year-end lists. And in 2021, he debuted Iphigenia, an opera co-written with the young bassist Esmeralda Spalding. Though Shorter didn't sound quite as distinctive as his forebears Coltrane and Sonny Rollins on the tenor saxophone, he was still one of the instrument's most original and important players. His 3.5-minute solo take on Thanks for the Memory, synthesizing Charlie Parker's bebop agility, Roland's raw power, and Illinois Jacquet's honk, never ceases to thrill, while his gorgeous balladry on A Remark You Made is a study in direct expression. And Shorter was the most influential soprano saxophonist after Coltrane. His serpentine and elliptical improvised lines, often turning in on themselves, echo his composed melodies. When you heard Wayne Shorter, you knew you were hearing wisdom, even if you couldn't quite grasp it all right away. Our second article is from the Ideas Department of the March 2023 edition of The Atlantic. The reason the recession hasn't happened yet. Despite soaring prices and interest rates, businesses and consumers have proved surprisingly resilient. By Annie Lowry. What happened to that recession? The recession we were supposed to be in right now, I mean. The one that various forecasters assured us was a sure thing. The writing is on the wall, many economists believed in June. A downturn was effectively certain as of October. Maybe the dip was already here, some suspected, and we just had to notice it. Or not. Unemployment is holding steady at its lowest rate in half a century. Layoffs are not increasing. The economy is growing at a decent clip. Wages are rising, and households are not reducing their spending. Corporate profits are near an all-time high. Consumers report feeling confident. So why were forecasters so certain about a recession last year, leading so many people to feel so pessimistic? That question has a few answers, some technical, some philosophical, and some historical. But the fundamental reason the much-anticipated recession hasn't arrived is that businesses and consumers have proved surprisingly resilient in the face of soaring prices and interest rates. And that resilience is in no small part due to policy. Washington fought the last recession well enough that it seems to have staved off the next one, at least for some period of time. Perhaps the simplest explanation for why so many forecasters seem to have gotten it so wrong is that economic forecasting is hard. The economy is enormous. Our knowledge of it is imperfect. Our data on it, retrospective. The number of things that can go right and the number of things that can go wrong are both gigantic. And the sample of recessions available to model and study is minuscule. The United States has been through just 12 in the post-World War II period. As a result, human beings are just not great at predicting a given country's rate of growth. The Economist magazine retains a database of annual GDP forecasts, now numbering more than 100,000. It is found that analysts tend to be off by 0.4 percentage points a quarter in advance, 0.8 percentage points a year in advance, and 1.3 percentage points 2 years in advance. These variations are significant, given that wealthy countries tend to have growth rates between 0 and 4%. The publication has also found that forecasters are the least accurate right before a recession hits. In other words, recessions are the hardest thing for analysts to forecast. The would-be recession that we are not having at the moment? The available data gave us straightforward reasons to expect trouble. The global economy was slowing down, and the Federal Reserve was hiking interest rates to tamp down inflation, something that caused a contraction in the past. Economists are stubborn adherents to history, Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, told me. When inflation is high and the Fed is aggressively raising rates, recession most often follows. Why not this time? In part because of a long simmering bottlenecks and shortfalls in the economy. Rising borrowing costs led to a drop in new housing starts, as economists expected. But construction activity did not slow down, because the backlog of projects was so substantial. Similarly, the jump in interest rates dampened consumers' ability to buy cars, yet years of shortages, particularly in the used car market, helped to sustain sales. More important, the American labor market turned out to be much stronger than economists had realized, and the American consumer far more irrepressible, thanks to the policy response to the coronavirus pandemic. When COVID hit, the federal government spent trillions on small business support and cash payments to families, meaning that low-income households did not reduce their spending, despite the jobless rate reaching nearly 15%. Indeed, they actually increased their spending. What's more, the strong policy response had, honestly, a bit weird effect of boosting private sector wages. Workers dislocated from their jobs scored significant raises when they went back to work. At the same time, because of widespread labor shortages, businesses have proved loath to let workers go. Of course, these dynamics are part of the reason so many economists expect a recession. The economy is so good that the Federal Reserve is trying to put a damper on it, to avoid high rates of inflation triggering a more chaotic and worse recession in the future. That might mean a slowdown sooner rather than later. Consumers have started to run down the cash cushion they built up during the early phase of the pandemic. Wage growth is stagnating. Inflation remains stubbornly high despite the Fed's rate hikes, meaning the central bank is likely to make borrowing yet more expensive. With a bit of luck and reasonably good policy making by the Fed, the economy should be able to skirt recession, Zandi told me. The widespread pessimism has served the purposes of the Fed, since it has weighed on consumer spending and business investment, which are critical to cooling off the economy and getting inflation back in its bottle. Or it might turn out that the forecasts of a recession were not entirely wrong, just early. Next, a technology article. The end of manual transmission. Stick shifts are dying. When they go, something bigger than driving will be lost. By Ian Bogost. I drive a stick shift. It's a pain sometimes. Clutching and shifting in bumper-to-bumper traffic wears you out. My wife can't drive my car, which limits our transit options. And when I'm at the wheel, I can't hold a cold, delicious slushy in one hand, at least not safely. But despite the inconvenience, I love a manual transmission. I love the feeling that I am operating my car, not just driving it. That's why I've driven stick shifts for the past 20 years. Your reader only drove stick shifts for the past 38 years. That streak may soon be over. When it comes time to replace my current car, I probably won't be able to get another like it. In 2000, more than 15% of new and used cars sold by the auto retailer CarMax came with stick shifts. By 2020, that figure had dropped to 2.4%. Among the hundreds of new car models for sale in the United States this year, only about 30 can be purchased with a manual transmission. Electric cars, which now account for more than 5% of car sales, don't even have gearboxes. There are rumors that Mercedes-Benz plans to retire manuals entirely by the end of next year, all around the world, in a decision driven partly by electrification. Volkswagen is said to be dropping its own by 2030, and other brands are sure to follow. Stick shifts have long been a niche market in the U.S. Soon, they'll be extinct. We can't say we weren't warned. For years, the stick's decline has been publicly lamented. Car and Driver ran a Save the Manuals campaign in 2010, insisting that drivers who learned to operate the entire car would enjoy driving more and do it better. A hashtag Save the Manual topic followed. Shifting gears yourself isn't just a source of pleasure, its advocates have said, or a way to hone your driving. A manual car is also less likely to be stolen if fewer people know how to drive it. It's cheaper to buy, or at least it used to be, and it once had lower operation and maintenance costs. You can push start a manual if the battery dies, so you're less likely to get stuck somewhere, and you can use the stick more easily for engine braking, which can reduce wear and make descending hills easier and safer. But the manual transmission's chief appeal derives from the feeling it imparts to the driver, a sense, whether real or imagined, that he or she is in control. According to the business consultant turned motorcycle repairman turned best-selling author, Matthew Crawford, attending to that sense is not just an affectation. Humans develop tools that assist in locomotion, such as domesticated horses and carriages and bicycles and cars, and then extend their awareness to those tools. The driver becomes one with the machine, as we say. In his 2020 book, Why We Drive, Crawford argues that a device becomes a prosthetic. The rider fuses with the horse. To move the tool is to move the self. Crawford argues that this cognitive enhancement is possible only when you can interpret the components of the tool you're operating. As the rider must sense a horse's gait, so a driver, the engine's torque. But modern automotive technology tends to inhibit that sensation. Power steering, electronic fuel injection, anti-lock braking systems, and, yes, automatic transmission obstruct the natural bonds between action and perception, Crawford writes. They inhabit the operator's ability to interpret the car's state and capacities through a healthy feedback loop of action and information. To illustrate the point, he tells a story about test driving a 400-horsepower Audi RS3 with all the options, including a paddle-shifting automatic transmission. It was powerful and capable, he said, but I could not connect with the car. That description is a common one among gearheads, a way of expressing that the human operator and the machine are out of sync. The stick shift has become a proxy object for that loss. When manual transmissions were the norm, drivers had to touch and manipulate the shifter in tandem with the clutch, constantly while operating a vehicle. Passengers saw this action taking place, and shifting gears became imbued with meaning. It represented the allure of the road, for all its good and ill, and stood in for the human control of a big, hot, dangerous machine screaming down the pavement. The manual transmission's impending disappearance feels foreboding not just because shifting a car is fun and sensual, but also because the gear shift is, or was, a powerful cultural symbol of the human body working in unison with the engineered world. Crawford admits that he might connect with the Audi if he put enough hours at the wheel. But even acknowledging this, the car left me cold, he writes. In part, that's because the coarse feedback that one gets while driving an all-electronic vehicle might be, or feel, too subtle for a brute human mind. Cars have, in a way, become too good. Human understanding slips off their surface like ice off a hot hood. The decoupling of humans from their driving machines will accelerate in years to come. If the automatic transmission made the stick shift a monument to lost control, the autonomous or self-driving vehicle aims to do the same for steering wheels. At that point, the loss will be so complete that it may not feel so alienating. Any pretense that the automobile is a prosthetic will be eliminated so car passengers can move on to other things. Like people on a train, they might settle into a book or take a nap or open up an Excel spreadsheet. But fully autonomous vehicles might never be in widespread use, and even mostly autonomous cars could be a long way off. In the meantime, the automotive industry will take away drivers' control in slow, lumbering steps, just as other industries have for other appliances, apparatuses, and services. You can now flush a toilet or operate a sink, not with the force of your hands, but by means of sensors. Web and product searches yield the results some third party wants you to see, rather than the best matches to your requests. Maps, now digital, show points of interest in place of raw information. Travelers let the apps that host those maps tell them where to go and how to get there. Customer service agents follow scripts to solve your problems. Your doctors follow automatic diagnostic templates. And the streaming platforms on your television calculate which shows you should watch next. People rued the decline of the stick shift for years before the Save the Manuals campaign spun up. But it may be no accident that the formal crusade arose just as computation overtook culture, steering human lives in the direction of technology companies and data aggregators' needs. Around that time, all the apps and services just mentioned, and many more, became widespread. The manual transmission, however marginal it has become during the smartphone age, remains a vestige of direct mechanical control. When a driver changes speeds, their intention can be fruitfully realized in gratifying action, meshing literal gears. Even when your hand slips and the gears grind, the device still speaks in a way you can understand. To lament the end of the manual transmission is to eulogize much more than shifting gears. When the manual dies, little about driving will fall away that hasn't already been lost, but we'll lose something bigger and more important, the comfort of knowing that there is one essential, everyday device still out there that you can actually feel operating. Even if you don't own a stick, or if you don't know how to drive one, its mere existence signals that a more embodied technology is possible, that it was once common even, and that humans and machines really can commune. The stick shift is a form of hope, but it's one we'll soon have left behind. Now, An Ode to Being Late by James Parker. Okay, White Rabbit, what's it all about? Oh dear, I shall be too late. Alice is drowsing on the riverbank. You rush past, startling her. From your waistcoat, you pull out a pocket watch. You consult it feverishly. Then you disappear down a hole, and she, amazed, follows you into Wonderland. Me, I'm always late, or about to be late, or working very hard not to be late, barely overcoming lateness. Oh dear, why am I like this? No Alice is made curious by my haste. No marvels ensue, just the serrated feeling of a pissed-off world. Squeezed horizons, clammy feet, these are the symptoms of a chronic belatedness. Why do I do it? There are theories, of course. One, I'm an incorrigible narcissist. Everybody must wait for me. Like a king or a comet. Sure, the weaker part of me will hustle along and stammer out apologies on arrival, but the royal cometary part is gratified. Behold, their lives were empty until I came. Two, in a low testosterone, 21st century blue state blah blah life, a life neutered by of genuine risk, this is what passes for adventure. I should be hunting caribou. I should be tripping with the medicine man. Instead, I'm checking the time every 42 seconds and cursing the law of physics. Am I that pathetic, though? Yes. But here's the thing about punctuality. It doesn't really exist. Perfect punctuality is a pinhead, a notational point on the continuum, a kind of Zeno's paradox. To be punctual, you have to be early, because if you're not early, you're late. And what does that mean? Does that early mean? It means padding your schedule with loose minutes, margins for error, insulating layers of dead time. It means waiting rooms. It means the trickle of the abyss. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland gives us two opposing principles, cosmic rhythm and counter-rhythm, the girl in her summery torpor, the palpitating rabbit. I choose lateness. It gives me velocity. I veer through crowds. I hurtle over interference. Here I come. And if you're waiting for me, relax. Stop scowling. I'm never that late. We're out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.